Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, welcome to the Kudzu Vine. For the first Sunday in June, we have Tim and Catherine with us. Welcome, Catherine.
Hello. Is it June?
It is. It's June 1st.
Oh, that's right. It's June 1st.
Yes, and
I was thinking it was the 31st.
And welcome, Tim.
Good evening, sir.
Yes, well, I've had a busy weekend, but in Alabama for a wedding most of the weekend. We dropped my son off at Camp Windshape, and now I'm going to talk a little politics. Have y'all been having a good time?
Yes.
Well, good. We're going to reset and have a Nan Orrock come on, Senator Orrock, and in the first part of the show, and then Keith Gross, State House candidate in one of the most targeted districts this year, is going to be on the second half, and then we'll do a little political talk all around those topics. But I guess looking, some Senate polls came out this week in other states besides Georgia. Both a poll came out in Mississippi showing Ronnie Musgrove leading appointed incumbent Roger Wicker, which obviously he's never run for that office. So you say incumbent, but it's not an incumbent like someone who truly wins the office. That was good news for us. Catherine, any thoughts on that poll?
Oh, I haven't really been paying attention to polls this week, but I'll pass it off to Tim.
Yes, well, Tim's kind of in and out, so we're out at that moment. But then another poll came out just this weekend showing Mary Landrieu with a narrow lead over John Kennedy in that that U.S. Senate race, and this was after some polls showed her lead, you know, really growing, and then, of course, the Don Casey win in a formerly Republican district. My thinking was, and I still think Mary Landrieu is going to be reelected, but I thought she was moving into very safe territory, but now this poll shows her with a very narrow lead. So that was titled on Swing State Project, a bit of good news for Republicans. It was like the first good news in a long time for them. Tim, we were talking about the two polls, Ronnie Musgrove showing him leading Roger Wicker, and then Mary Landrieu with a very narrow lead now on John Kennedy. Any thoughts on either of those polls?
Yeah, the new poll on the Landrieu race, I believe, has her ahead by three points, rather. This is a poll a little different from the last one that was taken down there. But I think this one's probably more in line with what's going on down there right now.
Yes, but then I was telling Catherine, I think with the Don Casey win, I got the sense that with us picking up that kind of seat that had formerly been Republican and winning it by, you know, close to 10 points, I just didn't think the Landrieu seat was going to be that competitive anymore. But now it looks like the Republicans something's happened to tighten that back up, or maybe this poll, you know, could be a bad sample. Who knows?
Well, that's also her history, you know, David. Close races has been the mark of her political career.
Oh, certainly. But, you know, I just got the sense that things were going to line up. And then, you know, if they don't have her as a target, you know, what is the Republicans' target? I mean, they have to defend a lot of places. But, you know, where do they even begin to pick up?
Well, she's the only target.
Her?
She's it.
Can you imagine a map like that? I mean, where they don't have any targets.
Well, I also think that people, I think there's a lot of interest in change this year, and it might not be, you know, all Democrats and Republicans, but just change.
Yeah. And then, so those were two races. You know, and then I think we were talking also, Catherine, after you left, the North Carolina race has had polls where either Elizabeth Dole has a narrow lead or is behind. She's under 50 in almost every poll taken. So now North Carolina's in play. I believe Ed Hulhoff at Tondi's Tavern had said, you know, the Democrats may have too many Senate targets, which I don't think you can have, but I guess I see what he was saying. But all these places, and then we started saying, well, if all these places are in play in the South, how can Georgia not be in play? It over to our U.S. Senate race.
Georgia can be in play also in the presidential race because of Bob Barr.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, that brings it in play where there'll be the pro and the con resources for each side. But that helps, I think, if the, you know, the Senate race falls out the right way. And it's real interesting, the DCCC, I'm sorry, the DNC sent up a presentation down to Georgia, and it had the Georgia Senate targets, and it didn't list Georgia as one of the targeted states. And I kind of joked with Ted. I said, I think I would, you know, take out my, you know, my Photoshop and color in Georgia in yellow just for us to keep us motivated. And he said, well, if this, you know, if the primary goes correctly, you know, Georgia can be yellow. And I'm going, it seemed like very interesting that the party folks were saying that there's a right and a wrong way for this to play out. And then given the situation this weekend, any thoughts on what the right or wrong way may be?
Well, however people vote.
Yes. I mean, but, you know, it's just very interesting that, you know, it would be like, hey, the right and the wrong way. I mean, I personally believe that, you know, Vernon Jones, he would get under what the U.S., I mean, what the presidential candidate would get, not over. And obviously the scenarios we look at Georgia being in play include a Libertarian taking, you know, upwards of 8 points. So, therefore, that's one thing to consider. But now, in our U.S. Senate race, we kind of had four things that happened this week. One was the AFL-CIO announced their endorsement of Rand Knight, which, I mean, the guy really has been doing as well as any candidate with endorsement.
Yeah, and that was a big surprise to me.
Yes, although when you look at that, he had endorsements previously from some union groups, not the AFL-CIO.
Oh, yeah, I mean, he's been doing his work. I just think that I think I expected people to rally around, you know, labor and the more traditional organizations to rally around Jim. And obviously, you know, Rand's been doing his work and was able to pull that off. I was surprised.
So Catherine, you say you see this as a blow more to Jim Martin than any other candidate?
Yes.
Yes. I mean, and Tim, your thoughts on that?
Well, let me first apologize for people listening to me. I'm having some phone difficulties up here because we're having some weather. But that was a very important endorsement for Rand Knight. I think that that endorsement has got to hurt Jim Martin and probably help both Vernon Jones and Dale Cardwell in jockeying for position for the runoff. Martin just seems to have come out of the gate flat. I don't know if I'm imagining that, but it just seems that way to me. He was supposed to be somebody that a lot of the Democratic establishment talked into getting into this race to, quote, rescue the thing. And he just hasn't gained any traction. I don't know if it's because he got in late or am I imagining this?
Well, I think he's focusing on raising money and, you know, he's concentrating on the people that support him and trying to get to continue to get their support. I don't know. I mean, I'm sure he's got a, you know, longer-term strategy, but that seems to be what he's doing now.
Well, as
I mean,
far as
there's tons of fundraisers and stuff.
As far as longer-term strategy, it's not that long until the primary.
I'm very aware of that.
So
it seems to be what's going on.
I think he's in some trouble. Don't you think so, David?
I do. I mean, it's just, I mean, he did have his website came out, and I'll freely say his logo is great looking. I mean, that website's very nice looking. That logo is just what makes it. But did he launch something really great too late? I mean, and that's just one, you know, that's just one piece there. I mean, it's everything. It's his appearances at forums are just now starting to come.
Yeah.
You know, I'd heard he was going to have a media buy coming a while back, you know, a week or two ago, and it hadn't happened. Maybe it may be that he has spent a lot of money in overhead, and then he's not going to be able to use money like he thought to actually get his name out there, which was going to be his advantage, was going to be his financial advantage, because maybe those first 2 or 3 weeks of fundraising, when he put in that $350,000, maybe that was kind of it, and it looked great. and then there was nothing else behind it.
But these other guys have been traveling the state for about a year now, going to these local meetings, shaking hands, getting to know people on a personal level, especially the party activists that'll have to help them get the nomination. And Jim Martin's not been out there doing that. I think he's lagging behind.
Yes, and really, I mean, everybody makes, because another thing I guess we got to talk about is Mark Taylor endorsed Del Cardwell. I think he had previously said he was supportive, but this week he gave a full description of why he supports Del Cardwell. So that was another thing that happened this week. But then people, you know, compare Mark Taylor's numbers to Jim Martin's numbers, but I think a better comparison would be Jim Martin's to Gail Buckner's. And which one of those ran ahead? I don't know if one of y'all can do the research. I'm afraid to leave the switchboard because of wanting to get our guest in when she calls on in. But if I'm not mistaken, Gail Buckner either equaled or surpassed Jim Martin's numbers.
I think it was about even. I'll see if I can find it. But
yes,
I
and so it's really, it's maybe, I mean, when you run as in an open seat, you're going to do one thing compared to running in a against an incumbent. And so, you know, it may be that, you know, maybe people, I think they like Jim Martin, but that may not translate into a lot of votes among swing voters. I don't know. It just, I think a lot of people are starting to see that something's just not clicking at this point. Now, there's still a, you know, over a month to go. But you can just sense it. But I guess the other thing, Josh Lanier did not interview in front of the AFL-CIO. That was, I guess, the fourth thing that happened this week with the Senate candidates. And I'd heard that the other four did, and I'd actually heard that Del Cardwell got some of the best ovations. And I think Jim Martin was very popular with the AFL-CIO as well. But Josh Lanier decided not to. Any thoughts on that decision?
What do you say? I mean,
his explanation was something about he's opposed to the whole idea of you know, interviewing with PACs or something.
Yeah, but these guys can put troops on the phones and knock
on the ground.
Doors. Oh my!
Yeah, and you know, and my thought is, you got to look at what the PAC is. If it's teachers and they're getting together and they want to help education, it's nurses and they actually want to make healthcare better. I mean, you have to look at that to me differently.
Oh yeah, it's a lot different than oil
companies.
Yeah, I think that's been one of the things that has driven me crazy about this whole conversation that we seem to have about PACs is that we lump them all together, whereas, you know, we've got labor unions who have PACs and, you know, nurses, teachers, all kinds of organizations that provide support and, you know, feet on the ground and voice on the phone for candidates. That's not the same as pharmaceutical companies or, you know, oil company PACs and lobbies. So, yeah. But we don't seem to be able to have that complicated a conversation about it in this country.
Yes, but I mean,
I've got those numbers, by the way.
Well, what are those numbers? That's just out of curiosity.
Jim Martin, 42.3%. Gail Buckner, 41.8%. So very close.
Yeah,
within
a point.
And then Mark Taylor was 38.2%. So
yes, but that's why I think that those are better numbers to compare Jim Martin and Gail Buckner, because they both were in the same situation. They're running for open seats, whereas, you know, you might have Republicans that ran against Tommy Ervin and Michael Thurman that did much worse because they were Democratic incumbents, and then and Democrats running against John Oxendine and Sonny Perdue were running against incumbents, the Republicans.
Right.
So I think you have to compare things together. So, I mean, it's just food for thought. I mean, you know, I'm not saying, oh, yeah, Gail Buckner should have been in that race, but, I mean, it's the same type of outcome in 2006.
In terms of raw numbers, David, they were separated, Martin and Buckner, by only about 25,000 votes. It was that close.
Yeah.
Yes, I mean, it's just something to think about in looking at this total campaign. I've actually had contact with Jim Martin's campaign manager trying to get him on the show, and I want to say this to anybody listening. If you're running for office, please, you know, contact this david@letyou.com, or you can call me if you can find my number on the DPG's website, and you can get on the show and be on with us, but we're trying to invite all candidates. So I know that they're making moves and they're trying to do things and tune it up. It's just, it's happening a little slower than one would expect.
Well, especially since he got in so late. I mean, if he had been in all this time, we would be in a different position, I think. But, you know, everybody else had already been running for, like Tim said, for some of them for almost a year.
Yeah, and it's kind of like, you know, I mean, he just didn't seem to be the field-clearing candidate that some wanted to make him out to be. But, you know, we shall see, you know, what happens in time. But then, you know, we're going to have probably the Rasmussen group, they did their poll about mid-May. That means within about a week, maybe about 10 days, we should be getting that next round, the Rasmussen poll, which seems to be followed up by the Insider Advantage poll. Then that'll be followed up by the Strategic Vision. So we'll get to see that, and that'll be the last poll I'm sure that's done, unless AJC does one right before Election Day. But I think we have our first guest on. Senator Orrock, is that you?
Yes, David. Am I talking to David?
Yes, ma'am. This is David. You're also with Catherine Smith and Tim Shiflett.
Great. Hi, Catherine. Hi, Tim.
Hello, Senator Orrock. It's nice to hear your voice.
Yes. Well, thanks for coming on. I know that you've got another contested Senate race, which kind of baffles me, but I'm sure we'll get into that later in the interview. But just kind of tell us about your career thus far in the House and Senate, even previously to that.
Well, I have been privileged to serve in the House of Representatives in a seat representing in downtown Atlanta neighborhoods since the late 80s. And I ran then last election cycle, that was 2 years ago in 06, for Senate District 36, the seat in the Senate that was open and that represents a good portion of Atlanta from south of Lenox Mall all the way down to the Atlanta city limits, the Clayton County line, all the in-town neighborhoods and downtown, South Atlanta, North Atlanta, and everything in between on the east side of downtown. So I have had one term in the Senate, and I'm running for that seat, hoping to serve a second term representing the good people of the 36th.
Yes, and I guess you made the move last year to go from the House to the Senate. What were your thoughts on that move, and how's it seem to have turned out so far for you?
Well, it's turned out well. I'm enjoying working in the Senate. I'm enjoying representing a wider swath of Atlantans, and the Senate is a smaller body. We have 56 members, and the House 180. You have an opportunity to be more connected with each of your colleagues in a smaller body like that. And I was the majority whip in the House the last term that the Democrats still held control in the House. And it's quite a sobering reality to be in the seat when your party loses power. I mean, the people in the U.S. Congress have been going through that in recent times. And so I left the House after serving one term under the new Republican leadership, and I was frankly ready to take on new challenges and get to know a new set of players, and I'm enjoying doing that in the Senate.
Yes. Well, like I said, we have Catherine and Tim on with us. I'm going to pass it over to Catherine for some questions.
Okay. Thank you very much, David. Thank you so much for being on, Nam. It's good to hear from you.
I'm happy to be. Thanks for the opportunity.
I know that you, you know, I'm familiar with you. I must say that you and I are friends, and I follow your career very closely. I'm very proud of you and proud that you represent, even though you're not actually my state senator, I feel that you represent me very well in the state senate.
I think we share a lot of values,
we
Catherine.
We certainly do.
Uh-huh.
And
I appreciate your activism and engagement in the political process. It's a real model of,
thank you.
I think how citizens can make a difference.
I think that one thing that people may not know is that you, as well as representing us in the state of Georgia, you also represent us nationally with the women's legislative lobby. And I wonder if you might just give us a few minutes, just take a couple minutes to tell us a little bit about that organization and some of the things that you do on the national level for state representatives or state legislatures. I think it's very interesting.
Well, thanks. I have been a part of a network known as the Women Legislators Lobby for more than 15 years. It was organized in the early 90s. And so I now head up that network, and we have more than a third of the women in the country who serve at the state level as senators and House members are part of our network. And we are a program of WAND, Women's Action for New Directions, and that, of course, you can find us on the website at www.wand.org. And it's a position that I really love because we are working to engage women, empower women to act politically, to take steps to reprioritize our national spending and our national policy, because right now we've got more than half of all of our discretionary budget every year is going to the Pentagon. And sadly, it's not going to make our troops safer, and it's not going to make our military families more secure with better benefits, and it's not going to beef up a veteran system for those who are returning from service in the military. It's going to a lot of outmoded Cold War weapons systems, very, very, very costly, fancy systems with fancy names that fill up the defense contractors' pockets, but don't do a lot for our security because we spend all that money at the expense of the spending that we need to be doing to make families secure, to secure a good educational system around the country, to protect our environment, and to deliver the countless services that families need and expect. And so we in the Women Legislators Lobby are a voice from the states and from the communities and from our constituencies to the federal government calling for redoing the national priorities so that we're doing a budget in a way that reflects the values that ordinary Americans espouse, and that is, you know, building a bright future for families, you know, good educational system, good jobs, good job training, environmental protections, communities that are safe. And instead, legislators often find themselves, you know, kind of downhill from the actions of the Congress on the spending that gets cut. We've all seen this battle go on over the last two or three years about children's health insurance. And broadly, Americans believe that having access to good, affordable health care and having health insurance for children is a sound policy. But we see that program constantly jeopardized and hanging in the balance, and the topic of big debates in Congress when Bush says that's spending too much money, we can't afford that. Well, yes, it's hard to afford common sense things like that when you're blowing billions of dollars on these Star Wars schemes that don't work, when you're ramping up to build more nuclear weapons and build nuclear bunker busters and pursue wars far beyond our shores that are not making us safer. In fact, some say the war in Iraq's imperiled us. So we have a very engaged network of women legislators across the country who go to Washington, who message to Washington, bring information to their members of their congressional delegations, and as well as run themselves. And 41 of the women that are seated in the current Congress came out of our ranks and were backed by us with our PAC. So that's the work that I do year-round with the Women Legislators Lobby, is to contend to organize and build the voice of women legislators from states and communities around the country for better budget priorities and better policy priorities in Washington that address our needs, as opposed to, you know, enriching the defense contractors and the folks that have figured out how to make money out of war.
Tim, you want to go ahead?
Yes, Senator, I'd like to ask you a question about something that an issue that I know that's important to everyone in Atlanta, and I'll just be blunt. Why has the Senate and House Republican leadership dropped the ball so badly on transportation?
Well, that's a good question, and I'm glad to see that many, many more folks who maybe haven't paid daily attention to the politics in Georgia are focusing now on when are we going to get some relief and some sound policy on our traffic and our congestion here in the Metro Atlanta area. Because as you all know, I'm sure we have some of the worst traffic congestion in the nation, of all the metro areas in the nation, and we have some of the longest commute time. And people find that the simplest things, trying to run an errand and certainly trying to commute to work, wind up consuming hours of their day. And it's really emerged to the forefront as an issue that's bad for our economy, bad for our mental health, and people are spending time sitting in traffic that they want to spend with their families. So we would think that responsible state leadership would have really moved aggressively to address this, and that's unfortunately not been the case. We saw that last year's the governor, in his address last year on the State of the State, didn't even mention the word transportation. That's right. And we know that historically the Department of Transportation has really been the highway department, and very much tilted in the directions of the folks that make and pour asphalt, and very resistant to mass transit, trains, buses, a robust mass transit system, which is desperately needed. And when you go someplace in the country, such as Boston, comes to mind, or the Bay Area, I mean, there's plenty of places you can point to, or certainly when you go, if you're fortunate enough to visit Europe, you see that there's a way for people to get around in a way that's friendly to the environment, more efficient, and not as frustrating as this traffic congestion with one man, one woman, one car that we seem to have. We need to really be moving to looking at new modes of transportation and addressing this congestion. And what happened, it's now history, is that on the last night in the Senate, we failed by 3 votes to put into place a transportation proposal that would have allowed voters in a region to decide whether they wanted to add a penny of sales tax to fund targeted transportation projects, including mass transit, in our region. Somebody that lives in Hihara is not having the same sort of traffic realities that we are up here. And if they're not ready and not supportive of going ahead with transportation solutions, let's not force it down their throats, but let's give our region of the state an opportunity to vote on coming up with some funding to do the kinds of transportation projects that we'd like to see. And overwhelmingly, the leadership, the Republican leadership in the Senate, voted one by one against that ballot initiative. And it torpedoed along with funding for trauma care. That too failed to move through this session, and we're losing 700 Georgian lives every year of people whose lives could be saved if they were served by first class trauma services within the first golden hour, the magic hour after a trauma episode happens, is when you need to have the best and the brightest working on you and pulling you through. Many people in many parts of Georgia do not have that, and our systems that are delivering that kind of trauma care, such as the Grady Hospital System, is a level one trauma center, the only one between Macon and Chattanooga, and that system, and Grady, as we all know, is imperiled from bad funding and from cuts that the federal and the state government continue to make to the reimbursement levels for Medicaid patients, and the fact that we have close to 2 million Georgians that don't have insurance. So Grady becomes a place that the uninsured go to, a place of last resort for the uninsured, and just have a hard time keeping the lights on, money doesn't work. So those are two huge strikes, I think, against the leadership in this session, that they did not deliver on either of those issues, transportation, Tim, as you were raising, and funding stream for trauma care. Two huge blots on the record.
Yeah, unfortunately, two of many, it seems like, David.
Yes. Well, Senator Ark, you had quite a time in the House, and you generally were unopposed running for House, but then now that you're running for re-election, and, I mean, I consider you like more than just a one-term incumbent. You seem like a multi-year incumbent. Why do you think people still want to run against you like they have this time with two people opposing you in the Democratic primary?
Well, I am in a district that's where two-thirds of the people are new to me. I mean, I think it's probably safe to say that among the regular voters in my House district, I'm pretty much of a, household name. I mean, people have known me for a long time and known my record, and I've worked on issues that matter to people, civil rights, civil liberties, health care issues, women's issues, environmental issues, and workplace issues, certainly. So this is a new, this is a district that's new to me, and it's three times larger. And I think that you expect always opposition. You're better off expecting opposition and then being pleasantly surprised if you don't have opposition than you are to think that you are never going to be opposed once you get your seat. I mean, it's actually healthy for a lot of people to be engaged in the political process, and we certainly are seeing that this year in Georgia. We're having such a massive we're having an upswing in voter registration around the nation. 3.5 million more people have registered, and I'm sure we'll double that between now and the fall elections. And we're having a lot of vigorous uptick in voter turnout and voter registration right here in our state. So in many ways, it's not surprising that all of that means that there are more people who take a notion to run. And there are people that don't that for whom it's no surprise when you see them putting their name on the ballot, because they've already been engaged in public service and have a record and have accomplishments to point to, and people have a sense of what they want to do, why they're seeking office. I mean, I've got two opponents who have not run before and who don't have any record to speak of. As they say, it's a free country, and I'm viewing this as a good opportunity to freshen up my ties and connections with people that have known me, and also introduce myself to people that may be new to the district or to whom I am a new face and a new name. So I think a good election cycle with some competition is, you'd rather not have competition, but the truth is you get out and see a lot of voters and touch a lot of people and get your message out, and it serves to reinvigorate your service, I think. So I choose to look at it that way.
Yes. Now, I know you've been focused on Atlanta Democratic politics, but now one of your opponents has run before. I know you're not focused on Republican politics, on Athens politics, on Augusta politics, but one of your opponents, Eric Underwood, apparently, he runs all the time. He runs for both parties. He runs in all kind of locales. I didn't even realize where he lived.
It's true he's not served before, but he has run before. That's right. He ran in that Congressional District 10 special election last year, and he ran as a write-in in the House seat, the Vine City House seat, against incumbent Mabel Thomas in 06.
Yes, and it seems like, I mean, and neither one of those locations are within your state Senate district, so it seems like this gentleman doesn't have a lot of roots, if you will.
Well, I think that's safe to say, and there have been questions raised about his residency that I think are going to have to be worked out by the Secretary of State before we all know, before it's all said and done.
Yes. Well, I just knew that had come up. Well,
you've been keeping, I guess, casting your eye around the state. You're based in Rome, David.
Yes, ma'am.
Isn't that right? Yes, and so kudos to you for even not realizing that he had been a candidate previously and on the Republican ticket, as I understand it.
Yes, and while Tim, Catherine, and I are each based in different places, it's our job to follow Georgia and Southern politics to keep up with the listeners' interest all around the state and region.
Certainly.
But
certainly.
Yes, but one thing we always like to do for every guest is, with you running for office, we just want to let you have a chance to tell people how they can help with your campaign.
Well, I'm encouraging people to contact me through nan@nanorock.com or go to my website, www.nanorock.com, and that's N-A-N-O-R-R-O-C-K. They can also call my campaign as well. Sometimes that's easier, 404-454-9183. And I'm welcoming people who live within the district that may want to host a meet and greet in their home and invite neighbors and friends. I'm asking people to put up yard signs. And as well, if you have some time to volunteer on the campaign, we'll be doing phone banking and can always, always use a ready hand, a willing hand. And it's actually, and I'm sure that all three of you have got varied experiences of working in campaigns, but it can be a very fascinating thing. If you've not ever worked in an electoral campaign, it can be very, very interesting to get involved. And, of course, we'll have a vigorous July 15th Democratic primary, and I'm running in the primary because, David, as you said, I have Democratic opposition. I have no Republican that's qualified against me, but I have two people that have qualified against me on the Democratic ballot. That'll be a vigorous campaign because we'll have a primary for our U.S. Senate seat. We'll be selecting the Democrat that's going to run against Saxby Chambliss in November. So there's going to be a lot of activity around this Democratic primary, and it's an interesting time to get involved, and people have until June the 16th. If you know people, if you have family members, friends, someone who's moved back to town or relocated here, they have till June 16th to get registered. And I'm a Fulton County race, of course. So, but across the state, and I know you have listeners across the state, urge folks that you know that have not gotten their registration papers in order to get registered by June 16th, and we would welcome and urge your support. And of course, you can always write a check to the re-election campaign for Nan Orrock. That is always welcome. And my website has the details on how to mail a check in or how to make a gift online through PayPal. So I'd welcome people to visit my website. That's www.nanorock.com. That's nanorrock.com. And hope to hear from some of your listeners in these next days and weeks before the July 15th primary.
Oh, yes, that'd be great. Well, we just thank you for coming on and sharing about your race with us, and we wish you luck on the 15th. And because I know about your good service, Buddy Childers, I believe you worked very closely with him as his vice chair. And Tim and I have worked in many of Buddy's races.
Absolutely. Buddy Childers is a remarkable public servant. I talked with the Honorable Buddy Childers just a few weeks ago, and he's still on the case. He was chair of the Health Committee in the House, and he actually recruited me to his committee, David. The year that I got elected, I was invited to a forum that fall before I'd been sworn in January, and I had the opportunity to meet him. And he said, I wish you'd get on my health committee. I'm the chair of the health committee. I said, I would love to be on that committee with you. That's one of my interests. And so he saw to it that I was able to gain that appointment by the speaker. And so I served with him on the health committee for 15 years, every bit of 15 years. And he came out of a labor background, and I came out of a labor background as well. And so we knew we had a lot in common when we met. He was the president of his local for the communication workers up in Rome. And I was had been working at Nabisco Cookie Factory here in Atlanta for, 16, 17 years, and was in the bakery workers union. So I had experience as a shop steward and working on the job and taking up issues like workers' compensation and unemployment insurance, you know, helping represent people. So we had that shared interest, and then we had our interest in health policy as well, which, of course, in these days and times is a front burner issue. I'm hoping with our new president we can move rapidly under a new administration towards universal health care. We have to get an approach to get everybody insured and covered. And Buddy Childers was committed to that, and a great friend. And I'd love to see Buddy run again, but I think he's more interested now in encouraging the new generation to get active and get involved. And I'm sure you all are seeing this, aren't you? The enormous new energy. I would say ever since Howard Dean ran for the presidential 4 years ago, that there's just but with the candidacies this year, there's this enormous interest among young people that is so welcome and refreshing, and I think gives us hope for the future. I mean, are you all seeing that in your various places that you work and engage in politics?
Yes, I mean, I think on college campuses it's gotten a renewed interest, and that may also be some negative. People see what they're getting from George Bush in particular, but the Republicans as well, not just a you know, what we're offering, but what the alternative was.
Exactly, and you know, I'm recalling that Tim, on your question on the transportation issue.
Yes, ma'am.
There is, and all the attention that's being paid to that now, I get asked about that at almost, I'd say 80-90% of the meetings that I attend. I mean, this is a big old district with 165,000 people, and so I'm in a lot of meetings. But that question gets raised over and over, and it's young people that are looking at it, environmentalists that are looking at it, but it's also business people who understand that when you've choked yourself on traffic, your whole question of economic development and the health of the economy starts getting called into question. And you all are, I'm sure, aware that on the transportation issue for this year, more and more people are coming to see that they've got to pull themselves together and work together for some solutions, and have, in fact, there's a coalition of almost 50 organizations that include the Chamber of Commerce and the Sierra Club and kind of everybody in between. So there's a real sense, I think, among the electorate that people need to get involved. They need to roll up their sleeves. That if we're that somebody else is not going to do this for us. I think in fact the significant elements in the business community have figured out that this leadership that we have under the Gold Dome, this new leadership that made so many promises, is in fact not delivering, and that, you know, to me, the big stink bomb that came home from that legislative session was that damn gun bill.
Yes.
I also think that
the economic situation with the cost of gas and the mortgage crisis and the cost of living in Atlanta, if you live in Atlanta, it has an impact on all this transportation as well. And I think those people who think ahead can think back and say, well, if we had thought about some of these things 4 years ago or 2 years ago or even a year ago, we might not be in such a bind. Like, for instance, Jerry and I, we own a small company, and we have 3 employees who drive as far as an hour or more to come to work every day, because they have to live outside of Atlanta because it's all they can afford.
Exactly.
I mean, we pay them well, but, you know, it's expensive to live in Atlanta.
Yes.
So now they're paying all this extra cost for their transportation because of the cost of gas. You know, it's a horrible situation. If our leaders, our Republican leadership, had a little more foresight, we might have been able to make that less painful.
Well, I agree, Catherine, and I would also point out that federally, going back to the conversation about how unwisely our federal tax dollars are being spent by this crowd, on the federal level, the money coming back to Georgia to help underwrite transportation projects, for example, is very much imperiled. We're spending so much to finance our national debt that is at a historic level. We're running a deficit. We're spending so much on the military, and so the transportation dollars that should be coming to Georgia, no guarantees on them, no guarantees on them. The same with, our mayor went to Washington in vain looking for federal support to redo Atlanta's aging sewage and water piping and infrastructure, all that goes along with modernizing our sewage and our stormwater. And cleaning up our water, all of that. There are other cities that went to Washington and received federal funds to help underwrite those enormous costs. That money has gone away. So from the top to the bottom, really, from the Republicans in Washington down here to the Republicans in Georgia, we have not been well served. And I think the sleeping giant has waked up, and more people are coming to see. Coming to agree with what you and I have known for a long time.
Well, Nan, I think we have another guest.
Well, great.
Right,
I have so enjoyed talking
well,
to you.
Well, actually, the guest hasn't called in, and Senator Orrock is such an interesting, engaging person to listen to. We're just fine. We don't want to keep you too long, though, either. But no, and Senator Orrock, that kind of brings up another question. I've noticed that at the state level, the Republicans have no solutions. They're just so against any kind of thing that they consider big government. But then at the local level, you see some Republicans doing things that might be considered government solutions. Like I heard just this week that the Gainesville or the Hall County government is opening up their own health clinic and building doctors for the employees because it's cheaper, even though it's government medicine. Or in Cayuga County, which was Republican-controlled, the government there pretty much provided the utilities, even cable, and offered it cheaper, even though it was government-owned and it wasn't private industry. Why don't you think the Republicans in the State House and State Senate would take more cues from some of their local leaders in Republican places like Hall and Cayuga County?
Well, I think what's going on is that the ideology that this party has been pushing and promoting, and we've been hearing it drummed in our ears from the echo chamber that they've built up quite effectively, I might say, over the last 25 years, is all of this anti-government, anti-government, anti-government. But the truth is people expect government to be a problem solver. They look to government for some protection of the consumer, they look to government to bring solutions. And so this big government, anti-government rhetoric that we've been bombarded with, when the gravy gets down to a low boil, as they say down south, when the pedal hits the metal, and when you're right down there in the real world, like at the local level, you see that hey, there's some realities here that we need to deal with, and common sense needs to prevail, not this anti-government ideology. And so I think over and over again you see that their ideology runs smack up against the real-life wants and needs of Georgians, just as it has across America. And quite frankly, I've seen the Republicans willing to meddle endlessly when they can figure out how to enrich their buddies, But when it comes time to look out for the little people, they're not real interested in that. We worked on foreclosure this year. That's a huge issue. 5 years ago, when Sonny Perdue got elected, they came in and stripped out our Georgia Fair Lending Act, and we became a state that offered no protections, very few protections to consumers. And as a result, here 5 years later, we have one of the highest rates of foreclosure. We are seeing, oh, my God, communities in some areas just devastated by the level of foreclosure. and we're all caught up in it, and it's damaging the home building industry, the home selling industry. It's damaging the individual family. All of us who may own houses in an area that's beset by foreclosures, and it's eroding the tax base, and we have a crisis on our hands with foreclosure, but we were able to get one small, modest bill passed in the session this year, and nothing of the level of engagement that's really needed, the attention that we needed to pay to foreclosure. We could not do that because the bankers' influence on the legislature is so severe and profound. And we're hoping for relief at the federal level as well. I know with the Democrats in control in Congress, they're working hard to do that. But their ideology about the government runs smack up against common sense measures that need to be taken at the local level. I will certainly agree.
Yeah.
It's been great talking with you guys.
Yeah, it's been great having you on the show. Thank you for coming in.
Thank
Absolutely.
You so much, Leah.
Happy to be here. Thank you, and we'll continue to stay in touch.
Yes,
thank
and we'll
you.
Look forward to your results on
July 15th.
15th.
And this is Nan Orrock, State Senator, District 36, signing off and thanking you for the opportunity to be with you and be a guest tonight. Appreciate
thank
it.
Thank you, Nan.
Uh-huh. Bye-bye.
Yes, well, that was certainly engaging. And, Catherine, I like how you were checking on me, but we did not have our other caller in, so I saw no reason why to cut Senator Orrock short when she was giving us so much information. But it is getting closer to the end of the show. So, Tim, why don't we go ahead with the outrage of the week?
Well, good, because it's going to be in keeping with the subject we've been talking about. There was a brief story in the AJC the other day talking about a speech that our lieutenant governor and former tuxedo store owner, Casey Cagle, made to the Marietta Kiwanis Club. Now, this was the same group that Cagle had made one of his first major speeches to in 2006 when he was running for his prison office. Last time, he was there to tell the group in a very ambitious way what he planned to do if elected. This time was a little bit different because he had to explain sheepishly why much of what he promised then had not been done. So he tried to do that, but what came out was essentially that the Republicans would try to do better in the future. Well, gee, I certainly hope so. They really couldn't do any worse, and they really can't point the fingers at anyone else for their failures. They are in charge. They have the governorship and firm control of the legislature. They control many of Georgia's counties. They also control the department where the state budget's biggest expenditures occur, the education department. And what have they done with their power? Well, not much of anything, unless you count infighting as an accomplishment. Their fights and squabbles got so bad this past year that they couldn't even get some of their own pet legislation passed. The Marietta group reminded Cagle with questions of just such a thing he had promised to deliver. He had plans to get $8 million approved for a charter school that would be attached to an aviation museum located near Lockheed. Well, the governor vetoed it. Not once, but twice. Amazingly, Sonny Perdue and his own lieutenant governor have not been on the same page for at least part of the time. And remember what happened to Speaker Richardson's tax plans? Well, to refresh your memories, nothing is what happened. The Republican legislature couldn't even agree on their holy grail of issues, tax cuts. And mainly they could not agree because Richardson and Casey Cagle continually butted heads. Then there's that education thing. The state spends more of its budget on education than on anything else. And I heard Casey Cagle in 2006 promise reform in that area as well when he was running. But then along came something recently called the Criterion Reference Competency Test. This test has been around now since 2000, so it's nothing new. Its purpose is to determine how well selected grades, in this case grades 1 through 8, can score on tests in the major fields of study such as math, science, English, and social studies. Well, the problem this year was the current social studies part of the test was designed at a level that many of the students had not yet achieved. Many in the state school system knew this. Then, when most of the students failed the test, state school superintendent Kathy Cox had to toss the results out. And what we ended up with was another Republican program with egg on its collective face because it looked like the Republicans had no idea what they were doing. And so Casey Cagle did his little dance the other day and gave no real answers to questions about all of these things. I suppose that's because he really doesn't have any answers. And he left the members of the Marietta Kiwanis Club scratching their heads in bewilderment. And this guy wants to be governor, eh? Well, he gives no solutions, but at least he did give us the Republican outrage of the week, David.
Yeah, thank you again, Tim. I know that there's a big week coming up. We got some conferences coming up this week. We have on Wednesday here in Atlanta, we have the conference on new media that Alan Crowe talked to us about in the blog special, still going on there. And then also we're having there's a conference that the 21st Century Democrats, the training group, they're putting on their national conference in D.C., and our friend Wendy Davis is going to has been planning that and is going to run that next week. Also, one of our first people that was on the show, Scott Aikman, is going to go up there and present. And Scott will actually be on the show with us next week because he and I will be on a remote, if you will, heading back to Rome. So Scott will be with us and can tell us all about how that conference went. So, and I'll attend the conference in Atlanta, so we should have some reports on that. And then the Alabama.
I'm also attending the conference in Atlanta.
Good, and that'll be some more people to talk about it. And then Alabama's having their primaries coming up, and we'll be watching those races. I know Congressional District 2, there's a competitive Democratic primary we'll be watching. And, of course, the 5th District, the Republicans are going to come up with their challenger for our candidate, State Senator Parker Smith, I believe. I may have
Griffith.
Got Parker what?
Griffith.
Griffith, yes. Thank you for correcting me, Tim. And then, of course, it may be that the presidential race is finally decided sometime this week. And given that there are a few things happening in the presidential race, the DNC meeting, Puerto Rico, and Obama and leaving Trinity United Church, in the last few minutes, Tim, Catherine, any thoughts on the presidential race? Catherine, want to go first?
Oh, I just want it to be over.
Tim?
I don't think there was a way to solve this Florida and Michigan thing without someone feeling shorted. So I guess, you know,
there
was no good way through that. So.
I thought they did the best that they could with that. I was actually very proud of that group yesterday that worked their way through that and got Florida and Michigan involved in the process again. If you're interested, with Puerto Rico results, we now have Obama with 2,070 delegates, Clinton with 1,915, with 2,118 needed to nominate. That's where we are. Up to
yes.
Today.
With two states left. And you know, really, and I just hear more and more that the joint ticket may not be as likely, although he may offer her a health and human services secretary if she wants it. She can be the person that heads up the health care initiative that he presents. But I don't think that brings in the voters that she would bring in by having her actually on the ticket. So I think that's important to remember. Also, Bernita put a lengthy post on Blog for Democracy about Obama's decision on the church, and that's kind of just a bad situation. If he stays with the church, people are going to criticize everything that the ministers may say. If he leaves the church, oh, he doesn't have a church, and obviously you can't really find a church in the correct way running for president because you need to kind of visit churches and get to know people. And when you're out on the campaign trail on Sundays, it's not like you can do that in the proper manner. So it's really just a bad situation all the way around for him to do it in the right way.
Look, David, there's been 35 million people voted in the Democratic primaries for those two candidates, and they are separated by a matter of a few thousand votes. I really think they ought to run together.
Oh, yes. I mean, but I just don't know that it'll happen. But then the thing is you don't hear what the backup plan is, you will. You're not hearing a lot of other names. And actually, the Republican talks, kind of closed down this week, too. You didn't hear a lot about the Republican side of the equation either. In fact, McCain, the only thing you heard about Republicans all week was not McCain, it was McClellan.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And I guess I'm going to... And by the way, are y'all planning on getting that book when it comes out?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think I'm going to have to get the audio book and listen to it. Catherine, any thoughts on that book?
I'll get it out of the library. He doesn't need my money.
Yeah, I think he's taking a lot of flack, but I'll say this. It's better that a man admits he's wrong a year or two after the fact than never admits he's wrong. And I bet we'll never hear Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, George W. Bush ever admit they're wrong.
Oh, yeah.
This man will admit that.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. I mean, it would have been nice if he'd done it before, but the fact that he did it at all was courageous, I think.
And they can't blame this on a liberal attack machine. This is one of their own talking about.
Oh, but he's gone liberal now, Tim.
Oh, yeah, sure he has.
You know, that's how they always say.
And pigs fly.
Yes. Well, look forward to next week's show, and we'll have that book in throughout the week and have a post up about what the agenda is during the week. Thank you, Catherine. Thank you, Tim.
Thank you. I'll see you on Wednesday, David.
Be good.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye-bye.